a massively wide-held assumption that the great performer is the great teacher, and actually they are two very different skill sets, similar in some ways, but those skills are tacitly learned through or informally learned through experiences with your own teachers and performing experience.
So we're back. Season two or series two, I don't quite know what you're supposed to call it, and I'm kind of borrowing that from Hugh at 80% Mental, because I'm now quite unsure of what the etiquette is, and it seemed to have triggered him on his first episode that they came back on with 80% Mental. Although I am curious as to whether or not series do sequels. I don't know. We're getting into something that I don't really know whether or not I should be exploring. But if they do do sequels, I really hope that we don't succumb to the well-known phenomenon in Hollywood known as the sequel curse, where we do not live up to the standard that we've set in the first installment. However, seeing as we didn't have a bloody clue what we were doing in series one, it's pretty highly unlikely that we'll fail to meet up to that standard again. But I do need to caveat that with the fact that I have mentioned Hollywood. I'm not suggesting for a second that we're Hollywood, but we do have royalty on the podcast now. It recognises royalty, podcast royalty, Dr. Anna Stoddard. You can talk to that or at that in a minute if you wish, Anna. But before we get into bringing our esteemed guests on, keen to just pick up with Anna and Laurie. You know, what's the crack? What have you been doing since series one, besides the obvious branding, of course, which Laurie will say was a team effort, but you've definitely been pulling the strings to make that happen, and we now almost look legitimate, even if we don't sound legitimate. We definitely do look a lot more legitimate than we did in the first episode, so thank you to that. So yeah, Laurie, what have you been up to since series two?
Yeah, big shout out to Nikki Salmon at Hiya Pals for doing our branding. And what have I been up to? Much like everyone else, I've been in my house, but very much following up on a lot of threads from series one, which has been really interesting, trying to make the most of lockdown.
Just bathing in the glory of being crowned podcast royalty, apparently. I don't know if that's a good thing or not, and I don't know what that means, but yeah. No, it's sort of mulling over some of our great guests from last series, and looking forward to speaking to some more varied and interesting people from lots of different kind of backgrounds and different domains, kicking off with today.
I'm not sure whether or not we call you Duchess Dr. Anna Stoddard or Lady Dr. Anna Stoddard. I don't know. We'll figure that out. Just before we get kicked off, Laurie, where can people find Nikki at Hiya Pal?
And it's the Right Honourable Dr. Anna Stoddard, actually.
You can find Nikki at hiyapal.co.uk. Good Scottish humour and great branding expertise.
Right, Laurie, L-Dog, please invite us into the episode and share with us what we'll be exploring and who we'll be exploring it with.
Okay, and this is probably the only semi-scripted part of this, but I have a wee intro. So as Derek said, this is episode one of season two, Feedback and Learning from the Perspective of Music, Sport and Education. So before I ask the guests to introduce themselves, I'll just offer a brief introduction as to why we've asked them to join us today. So starting with Ed, although I came across Ed's work in 2018, it was the short piece that he and Chris Cushion wrote for Impact in September last year that provided a really great talking point for myself and a number of colleagues following what felt like experiencing a rising tide of constructivist informed approaches to coaching. So having read books like How Learning Happens and The Coach's Guide to Teaching, their short article was genuinely like finding the lost bottle opener on a camping trip. And on to guest two. I've known Julia's family for many years, but it was our mutual friend, rowing coach Ian Dockra, that suggested that we get together at the tail end of last year, and that we did. She's been a great stimulus for my thinking over the past 6 months, particularly around feedback. And I'm really grateful to share this platform to discuss her work. And finally, when it comes to my readiness and willingness to engage in critical thought, I owe our final guest a lifetime supply of beer, David. So in our respective roles supporting learning and development of other people, feedback is certainly something that's come up on more than one occasion, so it felt like a great opportunity to invite him along. So knowing that great teaching can be found in any context, here we go, feedback and learning with cellos, footballs and chalkboards. I'll ask Ed to start by introducing himself.
Wow, lovely. That is some introduction. Thank you. I'm Ed Cope. So I work as a lecturer and support coach at Loughborough University, where I have been working since around Christmas time last year. So I've been there for a year and 3 months or so. So pretty much the whole of lockdown has been my tenure so far at Loughborough. Previous to that, I worked at the English Football Association for 3 years, where I worked in kind of a learning and design role. And then prior to that, worked at University of Hull and Sheffield Hallam, respectively. So jumped around a little bit, but kind of feel like I've found my home now. So my kind of research and teaching interests are focused very much on coach behaviour and practice. And I've collaborated with Anna on a couple of things and a recent publication that we've had. So I guess this is a good time just to flag that up and do the kind of thing that people do on these things, which is kind of signpost to your own work, I guess. So that was around the use of reflective conversations to help support coaches learning. So we might get onto that, I don't know, tonight, but great to be here, great for the invite, and really look forward to discussing with you all some of the stuff around feedback in the learning process.
I'm David Marsden. I'm the head of maths at a large non-denominational school in the west of Scotland. I've been teaching, I think, 11 years now. I've taught in the east of Scotland and the west of Scotland. A few years ago, started getting more interested in the kind of leadership aspect of it as well, and I've held posts in terms of working with families and also working with pupils in a more sort of pastoral sense, and over the last couple of years been running the maths department in the school. Feedback's obviously not all of my job, but a massive part of my job and of all of my team's job, and getting it right is absolutely crucial for improving the life chances of the kids in front of us.
Hi everyone, I'm Julia Wagner. I'm a professional classical musician. I've been playing the cello for 28 years now, and for 14 of those years I've taught students in one-to-one lessons. Over the last 5 years, alongside my performing and teaching, I've been researching and writing a PhD about verbal feedback that takes place in one-to-one vocal and instrumental lessons in conservatoires. Specifically, my research focuses on the subject matter or topics that take place in lessons. And also the intentions of verbal feedback. Both of these areas are really underrepresented in my field of higher music education. And that's really important because if you don't know what's taking place in a learning context, it's really hard to know how to create institutional feedback policy, or even to know how or what kind of teacher training is required.
Well, wow, some really exciting sort of experiences to draw upon in today's episode. So I'm looking forward to this. So I think I'll start with picking on Ed because I know him and I've worked with him. And I guess normally we come from a kind of sport kind of viewpoint on our topic. So we'll start with that and then diversify, I suppose. So Ed, what are your thoughts on the purpose of feedback in the learning process?
Thanks, Anna. I actually think that given where we draw our research from in sport most of the time, this probably speaks quite a lot to Julia and David's discipline areas or the more mainstream educational context in which they work. So hopefully we end up talking about something quite similar and draw upon similar type of work, because I think that's probably what's going to happen. So I think I'll start in terms of trying to, there's a teacher educator called Dylan William, and some of you may have come across his work, and he kind of talks about kind of feedback as being the most important part of the learning process. And there's work by John Hattie, who's a well-known educationalist, who has found really significant kind of significant findings related to the impact of feedback. And so his work and his research would suggest that, again, feedback is the most important part of the learning process. So in terms of, I guess, where it fits, I guess it's like everything. There's feedback as a behaviour, but of course we can break that down into numerous different types of feedback. And some types of feedback are not productive for learning, and some types of feedback are productive for learning. And then there's that extra layer of complexity, which is feedback works differently for different people depending upon who they are, their stage of development, and so on. So what works for one doesn't work for another. Without kind of reducing feedback to a simple state whereby we just say that, yeah, we give feedback and it leads to learning, we know that it's more complex than that, and we need to start dealing with quality and type of feedback and who the learner is, and starting to try and align all of these things. So looking at the work of someone like Paul Kirshner, for example, he talks in his blog about three types of feedback quite broadly, and so these aren't the only three types, but he talks about directive, he talks about constructive, and he talks about epistemic feedback. And so he isn't necessarily saying that one is worse than another, but if we start with directive feedback, that's prescriptive in nature, it deals very much with the what. If we look at constructive feedback, that deals more with the how. And then if we deal with epistemic feedback, that's kind of more towards what I would call questioning, to be honest, but that's more to do with the why. So you basically ask questions to try and evoke learners to explain the process that they've been through. So again, he isn't necessarily saying that one is worse than another, but rather if you're dealing with experts, we might come on and discuss what that might mean. And I'll be interested in Julia and Dave's thoughts on this. If we're dealing with experts, then epistemic feedback has been found to be most effective because learners have the knowledge, and therefore they don't need to be necessarily told where to look for something because it's a case of recalling or retrieving something that they've already done. Whereas directive or more constructive forms of feedback are probably more beneficial for novices because they don't have those skills and knowledge and therefore need more support and more guidance to help them with their learning. So I'm always conscious that I never really answer the questions that are asked on these things, but hopefully that's a starting point for some discussion.
Yeah, it's a pretty broad question. So Derek's got his hand up.
Yeah, I'm just interested in that word epistemic. So you talking about personal epistemology here as well, Ed. So somebody who deals with epistemic feedback might have a more sophisticated personal epistemology as opposed to, as you were talking around, you know, directive or constructive being very much in that naive space where they may not necessarily have that more nuanced relationship with knowledge, as it were, and that knowledge therefore informing their expertise. And I know I'm quoting Schumer a bit here.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, I think it's like with everything, what's the intentions of the person delivering this feedback, and do they understand what their intentions are? And so, you know, if they're able to rationalise why they use different types of feedback and that rationale is based on evidence, then I think we could be satisfied that the epistemology, regardless of whether it's more prescriptive forms of feedback, as long as there's a justification for it, and that justification, as I say, is evidence informed, then we're probably dealing with quite sophisticated epistemologies there, because the person giving the feedback would seem to suggest that they understand learning or understand their perspectives on how learning happens. So I'm not sure whether it's the type of feedback that the person gives that necessarily dictates whether their epistemology is more naive or more sophisticated, but rather the intentions behind the feedback that they give and their ability to rationalise and justify it.
Nice. So Ed kind of drew upon some educational theorists there. So David, you kind of looked like you recognised some of those names. Did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that Dylan Williams, like just a rock star in a lot of the circles that I've been in recently. And he, I think, one of the things that he really hits on the head is the idea about when you're in front of a class, when you're in front of a class of kids, if you're not comfortable, it's really easy to get stuck into that praise where all you want is to initiate some sort of dialogue with the kids, that the minute they say something, regardless of whether it's actually useful or it's right or it's a good contribution to lesson, people are so quick to praise. And all the time right now, we're fighting the ego of the kids all the time. They've been locked up in their house for the best part of a year, right? They've not been in school. They've been plugged into social media like TikTok, and they are more and more self-conscious, and it becomes harder and harder to feed back to them about the tasks at hand, to give them practical, actionable, easy to understand feedback that's going to help them to improve their learning. That is becoming harder and harder. And right now, like this week, the hardest it's ever been. Like, usually when you give the kids a break in their learning, you say, right, guys, just have a chat for a little bit, you know. They don't talk to each other. They pull out their phones and plug back in. You know, they're numb. And without that dialogue, without there being any relationship there, it's really difficult. So his point about feedback being about the task and not about the person itself, that is now one of the biggest problems that we face. It always has been, but it's now more difficult than ever.
I'm glad to hear it's not just me that doesn't get any response from students when we ask them to speak to each other. Just having a conversation with someone just seems so difficult these days. We'll move on to Julia. So what are your thoughts on that kind of role of feedback then in learning from your perspective?
Well, from my perspective, considering adult learners in the one-to-one performance music learning, feedback is at its most basic level, it's advising on issues that require further knowledge and offering different strategies to achieve specific goals. And it's basically a way that can help students troubleshoot their own performances and also self-correct. It can help people take action to reduce the discrepancy between their intentions and the resulting effects. It's obviously, just as Ed said, it's known to be central to learning, and its actual influences is variable. You can get feedback from various sources, so teachers, coaches, peers, and also the media, and in the one-to-one context, in classrooms, and also with coach and athlete, you get written feedback, you get verbal feedback, and you get non-verbal feedback. For musicians, obviously, non-verbal feedback, you can imagine, you know, what we do is we have instruments, and the instruments are our voice, you know, they're an extension of ourselves. And so automatically we are offering people non-verbal feedback through performance. But the thing that's mostly relatable between Ed, David and I, our three fields, are this non-verbal and verbal feedback when you're considering interpersonal communication. My research focus is verbal feedback, but what you have to consider and you have to acknowledge is that verbal and non-verbal feedback have to be, they both have to be considered. So if you imagine, like, for example, you have a coach that says to an athlete, oh, you did a really good job, but they're frowning. So their non-verbal feedback is not aligning with their verbal feedback. So, and I read a study lately that was talking about how if the two don't align, then humans naturally will actually read the non-verbal feedback 7 times more than the verbal feedback. So that's actually pretty significant if you're considering feedback and learning. And also the last thing I'll say on it is, if you're considering feedback, you have to, just like Ed said, you've got to consider the overarching aim of learning. And if learning is the task, is the outcome in a really broad sense, if you consider feedback in that way, anything that's communicated between your mentor and your apprentice or your coach and your athlete or your student and your teacher is feedback. It's being absorbed. You know, both the student and teacher are absorbing feedback, and you're offering that feedback both verbally and non-verbally. And I think that's something that perhaps the word feedback, it comes with assumptions when people talk about it. And I like to think of it as a much more natural process that happens, is kind of part of just interpersonal communication. You know, you're reading my nonverbal right now, and you're listening to my verbal feedback, and hopefully they match. But so it's really important to consider all of these things when you're thinking about feedback.
Real quick on that. Thank you, everyone. I know, Ed, you've got a point you're keen to to revisit from those various contributions. Derek's put something in the chat there that has acted as a great reminder. Part of the discussions Julie and I have had over the past 6 months is doing this comparison between sport and music, which has been really interesting. And something she wrote in an email to me really stood out. And it was of musicians learning to play instruments from a really early stage in their development. They're encouraged to reflect upon or share their affective state and communicate that through their music, but that also requires them to verbalize it. So what emotion might you be seeking to portray when you're playing this piece? And when I was in a Sport Scotland webinar recently and Jamie Taylor was presenting, he's really interested in the role of emotion in feedback. And I offered this question around, you know, is that something as athletes we could encourage them to do more? So just to be able to communicate and articulate and draw upon their feelings and emotions throughout their development. So just a brief reflection for me. Thank you, everyone. Derek had his, or Julia has her hand. We're now going for physical hands up, which is great. So either Derek or Julia, maybe jump in and then we can go back to Ed's point.
I was just gonna say, what's so interesting about music, like you've just touched on it, the need to display emotions on stage is perhaps arguably, you know, with most sports and music is quite a big difference. And then we have to also describe that in lessons. And there is literature about feedback in lessons, you know, the use of metaphorical language, you know, really talking about musicality and creativity and how that's discussed. And a lot of observation and demonstration is involved in that, you know, how you move can influence how a student's moving and all sorts of things. But it really brings to light this anecdote as well, in terms of when you talk about emotion in life, when you talk about, well, in life, it affects your music, you know, the anecdote about art imitating life and life imitating art. So it's very much reflected in our training, and we're stereotyped as emotional beings, and perhaps because we have been trained to be for such a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to make a really quick point on that notion of emotion, and I think it's Capio and Rapson describe it as emotional contagion, where, you know, as humans we've got this propensity for synchrony, and therefore we begin to mimic unconsciously the gestures, the mannerisms, the slight somatic data that people give off. Irrespective of what they're telling us verbally, their aura, their way of being is perhaps telling us something else. And of course, that leads to that phenomenon of contagion. So, you know, if I'm being really negative in terms of how I'm expressing myself unconsciously, then that negativity has a propensity to spread amongst the people that I'm working with. And it definitely speaks to what you're saying there, Julia, and I didn't recognize this, that, you know, there's that sevenfold increase in what we pick up unconsciously and non-verbally than what we do verbally. So to what extent do we, as educators, as coaches, as developers of people, try and keep those things in check? How effectively sensitive are we to how we are being at any given moment in time, but equally how empathically accurate are people who sit around us, and being able to pick up on such things, because kids aren't stupid, athletes aren't stupid, students aren't stupid. So they know what we're bringing to every given moment when we're trying to educate them.
I really enjoyed that. I was thinking about just sitting on the just so far from the experience you're describing there, Julia, because I teach mathematics, right? I mean, it's the pursuit of objective truth, right? It's like being hopelessly delivered to something that is objectively true, and the emotion comes into it in a really different way. There's like before kids in Scotland get to sit exams, well, they're doing this broad general education, as they call it. There's 8 curricular areas, and if you leaf through it, you can read, you know, what the kids are supposed to learn in music, and some of that is the just being able to describe the emotions that the music they listen to evokes in them, or in English discussing themes or characters and whether they related to them or not. And then you flick to the maths ones and it's like, I can use my knowledge of factors to determine whether a number's prime or not, right? Well, 7 is prime, right? And there's nothing on the other side of that argument, right? And so there's no emotion in that, right? You're objectively wrong or right about that, and it doesn't matter what your opinion is. But the emotion is when you're trying to get a response, a written response, a verbal response, some sort of action that shows the pupil engagement with the lesson from the pupil. You're trying to elicit that from them. That's where the emotion is, right? So it's how they feel in the moment, whether they feel comfortable or not, whether they feel safe, right, to get it wrong. And that it's for me, the emotion is getting them into that, a good emotion in which to learn in the first place. Because if they find themselves on the wrong side of these objective facts too often and in the wrong environment, then they just learn this. It's just a stress response, right? You only need to call upon them for the most basic answer and everything goes out their head. You know, and when they come to you in that from a previous learning experience, whether it's in maths lower earlier on in education or from another classroom, like breaking that down first, that's the hardest bit before you get to any of the, you know, you know, 7's prime.
I think just following on from the point around emotions and kind of whether it's athletes, students, musicians sharing their emotions. For me, I think that's a really good indication of being able to inform a pedagogical approach. So if we're talking about that in relation to feedback, then if we're able to listen to what our athletes are saying or what the learners are saying in the broadest sense of the word, then that should really inform how we're there to support them. So I guess coming back to your point, Dave, around kind of that notion of if the student keeps getting the answer wrong or keeps being on the wrong side of the mistake, then kind of this might be a shameless plug into instruction a little bit, although feedback is part of kind of an instructional approach. But I guess this is where we recognise the need to scaffold and the need to offer guidance and support and the need to, you know, reduce the complexity of what it is that we are teaching in order to ensure that success happens, so that then raises perceptions of competence and with it enjoyment and with it the likelihood that sustainment of participation is going to happen in whatever context that might be. And so if we're able to evoke our learners' emotions and we're able to listen to that, then that really is a really useful mechanism by which to understand kind of how we need to engage with them, what types of feedback we maybe need to give in order to best support their learning.
Ed, you mentioned there about instruction. What is instruction? And sometimes it's got quite a bad rep. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess like anything, you know, it's a socially constructed term, isn't it? And so depending upon who you speak to will tell you different things. But I guess that was the sentiment really of the article that Laurie referred to at the start, which was trying to redress the balance of how people were talking about this term or what they'd understood it to be, and most importantly, what they didn't understand it to be. And so I guess the way that so Chris and I approached the topic was really in response to the academic research and discussion on social media regarding how, you know, direct instruction was being portrayed. And, you know, so really the narrow definition, the misassociation of certain terms, the general disregard really of when and why instruction might be needed. And so, you know, you hear a lot kind of, you know, shouting at kids from the sideline isn't acceptable. But that often gets and nobody would agree that that is acceptable or that is purposeful in any sense of the word. You know, you hear a lot about kind of unethical coaching, being really critical of athletes. Again, nobody would agree that that is appropriate in any context or any of the time. And yet these type of sayings or terms were being associated with direct instruction, and kind of that isn't what it's ever been intended to be. But somewhere along the way, and particularly recently, that's how it started to be conveyed. And so part of the exercise was actually to go back 25, 30 years and look at some of the earlier work that spoke about teaching games from understanding, which was really the first game-based approach that was discussed in any real detail, and how that was associated with a constructivist kind of learning theory. And yet there doesn't seem to be any reason why that was the case. And terms such as situated learning and athlete-centered, as you know, was followed in terms of its association with kind of constructivist informed approaches or discovery based approaches from a pedagogy point of view. But actually, you know, if we go back and look at the educational psychology literature, which far preceded any work in sport pedagogy, you know, they've spoken about direct instruction in very kind of eloquent and very specific and very detailed ways. And really, they don't draw upon any of these kind of comparisons, and they avoid any of these dualisms. And so, you know, really, if you look at Rosenshine's principles of direct instruction, I'm sure that a lot of people working in coaching and in education would probably say, well, that's not direct instruction. That isn't what I've come to understand it to be. So I think that, again, what we tried to do was to try and, well, reconceptualize, and put it back on the table in many ways as part of a coach's repertoire. And what we're not saying and what we've never said is that, you know, coaches should be doing this all the time. It's like that point about feedback. It's about selecting, you know, or helping support coaches in understanding when is the right time and equally when isn't. And so, you know, this isn't about preferencing direct instruction over anything else. But what it is saying is it's an important part of a coach's toolbox, for want of a better phrase. And so we need to kind of get discussions back on the table and not be scared to talk about it and help coaches understand, you know, when it should be used based on this broader conceptualization of it being a series of behaviors and having a theoretical basis in cognitive load theory, which maybe is for another day.
Yeah, the sentence that stood out for me in that article was that it's more than a single coaching behaviour, and you just sort of touched upon it there. So what are the behaviours then? What is it?
Yeah, so I think we also say in the article that we as probably a group of people that talk about coaching behaviour are probably to blame as well for thinking that it is only that, because systematic observation work, and those that are familiar with systematic observation or any observation template, for that matter, often breaks behaviour down into a very kind of very isolated kind of single behaviours. So that narrow definition is something that we've contributed to, and we acknowledge that. So, you know, if we were to take kind of Rosenshine's principles of direct instruction, which I think is the best explanation I've seen, you know, it includes asking questions, it includes checking for understanding, it includes giving feedback, it includes independent practice, it includes scaffolding. And so, in other words, kind of reducing support or fading support as learners become more proficient at the skill that they are practicing, or as they increase their knowledge and are therefore able to understand what it is that they're doing more. So it's a range of different kind of behaviours that contribute. And as I say, it's really around the coach understanding kind of, you know, who's in front of them, who the learner is, what the intentions of the learner are, what it is that the learner needs from the coach, and ultimately the coach responding accordingly. And that will invariably mean at points that they are more directive, that they offer more guidance, and that they offer more support. But again, that isn't to say that they would do that all the time.
Ed, thank you. So interesting. And like music to my ears. And I said at the beginning, keep really keen to hear Julie and Dave's thoughts on this. I said at the beginning that I had experienced what felt like a rising tide of what was really questioning. And I want to be specific in that was in a context within a sport. And what I was noticing in the learners, if we go back to the idea of emotion, was that they appeared really frustrated. And what I saw was individuals that I don't think had sufficient knowledge to creatively explore the problems that were being set for them. So some were okay and others were really struggling. And I think if you move across sports and move across discipline, you know, out with sport, be that music or be that education, then the ideas that are most in influence at that time will differ. So I think there are sports that perhaps could utilise more games-based approaches and peer-to-peer learning. But I came across a quote that I actually wrote down for this. It's just a wee short paragraph from Doug Lamont's recent book. I think that's his name, right? I know It Depends is chucked around a lot in sport just now, but it said the answer to so many questions in teaching is it depends. But that doesn't mean all answers are equal. There's still science, and it will guide you towards better answers and away from lesser, sometimes more familiar ones. And even better than that is that there's still plenty of room for it depends. So within everything that you said there, Ed, it's dependent upon the learners. There's a variety of options, and it's about being deliberate and considered about what we choose at that point in time and when we're working with them. So yeah, I'll move to Julia and Dave. You know that I have plenty of thoughts to share by now.
I actually would really like to just jump back to what David was saying and then back to Ed. and I wanted to just bring it back to this nurturing that you're doing, David, that you're trying to nurture this safe environment and this issue of praise. And what it sounds like, it really rings, it reminds me of Carol Dweck's work about mindset and creating safe environments and what kind of feedback you give and the outcome of that feedback. And so she talks about fixed and growth mindsets and the different types of feedback that influence the creation, I suppose, or development of those mindsets in your students. And if you praise the process, you develop a learner that's got a growth mindset. And if you praise the outcome, you're enabling you're enabling fixed mindset. Did I say that the right way around? Yeah, outcome, fixed, process, growth. And what they are, having a fixed mindset is your if you praise the outcome, you're basically enabling a fear of failure and avoiding people like that, avoid situations that they could fail. And what you're doing is you're trying to create a safe environment so that they can fail and learn from it, which is what people with a growth mindset have. I just wanted to add that to what you were saying. I actually have a question about direct instruction, because what I read or assumed of direct feedback or direct instruction could be various things, and one of them could be the manner that the feedback is delivered. So you could say it in a direct way, you know, you can say your feedback in a kind way or sensitive, you know, you can be quite direct in the way you're saying it. Or it could be about the timing, or it could be about the actual just plain instruction. I just wanted to know if there's a difference between instruction and direct instruction.
I guess I can answer that. I think direct instruction refers more to a kind of a broader approach, whereas maybe instruction refers more to a single behaviour. And I think you raise a good point, Julia, in that what we tend to have become obsessed with, particularly in sport or in coaching, is like comparing one thing versus another. And so we create these binary notions of there's something that's good and something that's bad. And I think that's really unhelpful. And actually, we'd be better spending our time as an area of study, focusing on like what constitutes quality. Because, you know, saying direct instruction, you know, it's neither good nor bad, but rather you can get good direct instruction, you can get equally really bad or inappropriate direct instruction, because like we can with anything. So whether it's a question approach, whether it's a game-based approach, whatever it might be, you know, there's good versions of it and there's not very good versions of it. And so I think some of these things that you say there in terms of like what's the manner in which it's said, what's the timing of it, what's the actual content that's said, so what's the information that's actually given, is that helpful or not, how much of it is said. So we know that we can quite quickly overload people by giving too much instruction, and I think that's where people often have their issues and And that's maybe a lot of the information that I see is that, you know, yelling at kids or shouting at them all the time. But as I say, you know, that isn't my understanding of direct instruction. You know, that's just inappropriate coaching, you know, as simple as that, really. So there is a load of things that need to be unpacked. But I think they, again, you know, we need to be talking about what constitutes quality direct instruction. And I think any discussion always needs to be based on that and helping coaches understand what that looks like.
Yeah, direct instruction plays obviously an absolute fundamental role in any, you know, teacher, regardless of which part of the curriculum they're in. But in maths, it's often seen as not particularly creative part of the school. And that's where the direct instruction comes in, because it seems quite narrow. And again, you've got the objectivity of the learning intentions you're trying to achieve with the children. But I think what we're always fighting against is not having enough time, you know? So like right now, when we've had like literally 12 kids in a class, right? So you need 2 or 3 times the number of teachers to deliver that, and 2 to 3 times the number of space to do that, right? But you can't do that, so you have to half the number, the amount of time that they're in school. So all you do is default back to direct instruction and completely overload the kids, because you're trying to catch up on everything that they've missed during these lockdowns. Whereas in an ideal scenario, it's just what you were saying, Ed. You use it with with a class of 30, you try and use it to the appropriate degree that's going to benefit as many of the learners as much as possible. Because that old chalk dot, so the kids go in, you register them, and then you give them direct instructions for 20 minutes and you expect them to practice it in silence, right? We are competing with some just a practically infinite things that compete for their attention these days, and or functionally infinite things that we have to compete with their attention with. So I think that there are some abstract ideas that I can only achieve through direct instruction, but I think it's arriving at the right point for the learner, so they know why they need to learn this. They know that the tools that they have are not going to get the job done. So they have to arrive at the problem organically before the direct instruction becomes effective. And that often means that you have to take a more, you want to investigate a problem, you know, and do some questioning and really find those pivot points, those hinge points, and ask less, you know, ask less of them. And I think a lot of the time I feel the less that I'm speaking and the more time there is explicitly for them to think, to organize their thoughts, to talk to each other or in groups in a way that is that they know, you know, like whether it's talking in pairs or talking in groups, or like what's a paired voice, what's a group voice. At that point, you can arrive at, right, OK, right. So how do we solve this problem? And then the direct instruction becomes really beneficial. And there's still a place sometimes, you know, for raising your voice a little bit just before that happens. Over to you, Derek. Yeah.
You sparked a thought in me, and I think I just want to bring it back to Matt, and I'm going to frame a question, and Anna might laugh when I say this question's half-baked, because I tried a half-baked question already this week, and we know how that landed in terms of a comment from Anna, which was, it can't be half-baked if you've planted a reference in it. I'm just interested in math, okay, and your pedagogical approach within that, because you talked about in being in search of absolute truths. Yes, 7's a prime number, but equally there's creativity in math, right? And you're ultimately dealing with logic, and therefore you're dealing with reason. So it's probably one of those subjects where you can develop that mechanism of reasoning in people, and therefore move them towards a point where they're developing critical thinking, critical thought. So I think it's a fundamental subject area, subject discipline, in supporting people to think for themselves.
So, sorry.
No, keep going, mate. It's fine.
I mean, there's a tension there, isn't there? So all mathematics is problem solving through pattern recognition. And mathematicians... Right, mathematicians, what they really do, what people who are employed, loosely say that, employed to be mathematicians, people that a lot of them are employed to be lecturers, and they do their maths in there. In the time that they're not doing that, they are being creative, right? And they are linking together sometimes previously unlinked branches of maths in really unique ways to solve problems that maybe they didn't even know they could solve, right? So they're discovering ways of describing the patterns that we encounter all around us every day, and we would be lost without them. But in truth, that's where the person that love maths wants to get to. But to get to there, they have to just meet all these objective standards and tick all these boxes, right? So we are developing problem solvers so that they can pass the exams that our communities and societies think need to be passed for them to get the opportunity to take it to the next step. And we have a lot of kids in front of us who are fantastic process learners and are really comfortable getting stuff wrong and have that growth mindset that you're talking about, Julia. I worked with the Winning Scotland Foundation a lot on promoting growth mindset within schools. And we have other kids that are really afraid to fail, but their parents give them all the tools they need to get there. And then sometimes things falls apart at uni when they don't have all that support. And there's other kids in the school that you're trying to be more creative about and take a more equitable approach to give them other ways to be successful. And we've introduced other courses that are less abstract maths, more applicable, you know, everyday maths, so that they can still be successful and take problem solving into their life where they'll need it. But in terms of my practice in the classroom, the creativity can come into it. But again, that's usually when, as Ed was speaking about earlier, where they are now more expert in a branch of maths that they've been studying at that level. And at that point, you can see the difference between a really blunt, you know, knuckle dragger approach to problem solving and something that's really elegant and concise and really beautifully put across. And you often get that from kids that are further down the road. But that is really exciting. And I mean, I'm not teaching in any kind of selective environment, right? I have everybody from, the measures of deprivation. So from like 1 through to 10, I see everybody. And that means that we have to cater for everybody and find ways for everybody to succeed. But the few times that I have the kids in front of me that I know are already better than me, like that's as good as it gets. I still get the same sense of achievement from helping kids that have really difficult backgrounds who are less mathematically able at that point in their lives being successful. Like, I had some real big win stories over this term. But yeah, when you have the experts and you can get down to the creativity of the solution, and sometimes you're marking a script and you thought, God, I would never have thought to do that. Like, that's amazing, you know? That's where the creativity comes in for me. Yeah, and that's fantastic. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks, Dave. Before I come to Ed, I'm going to take a little bit of a swerve ball on this one. And you described the supporting the students to solve maths problems, which in turn will support them to deal with broader problems, right? In terms of supporting them to think in certain ways. Feedback presents as a problem for students, right? It presents as a problem for musicians. It presents as a problem for athletes. So if that's a problem to be solved, how do we support them to solve problems like feedback, be that through direct instruction or otherwise? Because, sometimes it is difficult for people to deal with the feedback that they are receiving, whether it's well-intended or not, whether it's intended to be challenging or whether it's intended to be supportive. So how do we support people to solve the problem of receiving feedback?
Wow, that's a great question. I guess one of the things there is, and again, you know, there's studies that have identified that unless feedback is acted on quickly, then it loses its effect pretty quickly. And so there is a definite importance to ensuring that whatever feedback is given, that it is understood and it's acted upon. So I guess the first thing would be, how are people understanding the feedback that we're given? And is it being received in the way that's intended. And so by its very nature, I guess that we would want people to explain, do they understand what that feedback is, and can they tell us that they understand what the feedback is that they've received? And I guess that, you know, we see that, or Anna and I will see that, and Julia and Dave will see that in their context. But if we take it in a higher education context and we give feedback on work, like we get the same work next time, then clearly that feedback hasn't been received, or they either haven't read it, or they've read it but they haven't understood what's been said. And so that definitely isn't done enough in higher education in terms of sitting down and saying, right, tell me that you understand this feedback, or show me that you understand this feedback and tell me how you're going to respond to it. But I think that's probably the first step in ensuring that that is done. I don't know whether that's answered the question, Derek, but that's what I would think about doing.
Yeah, I think that the threads that I was beginning to pull on there was similar to what, or going back to what Laurie was saying and quoting Doug Lamov around, you know, knowledge, some items of knowledge or some things having equal value. Well, what we're maybe subtly talking about there is our relationship with knowledge, or ability to interact with knowledge, and therefore our ability to interact with feedback. And I suppose it's the dispensing of feedback from an authority, maybe early on in as a student or as an athlete, just taking that as an absolute. And I suppose when I start beginning to talk about the problem of feedback, well, as people's relationship with knowledge of a knowledge in, say, maths, or knowledge of a knowledge in music, or knowledge of a knowledge in football, they begin to question the feedback that they receive, because it might be in tension with or at odds with their own ideation of what it is that they're trying to achieve. And so, I think that's actually a really good thing, because it's that dissonance between what the learner believes and what the teacher believes, or what the coach believes, is where real learning begins to emerge. And we start going back to that sort of epistemic type of feedback you were talking about at the start, Ed.
Yeah, it's an epistemological gap, isn't it? Ultimately, that's what it is, you know, in terms of that dissonance, as you say, from probably what you think you need to do, or what you think you're good at, versus what somebody else thinks you need to do and thinks that you're good at. And so, yeah, how do you reason between the two things, and how do you help people understand kind of where they are at in their learning and the type of things that they need to get better at? And this is the classic, isn't it, is that often you're not going to learn something if you don't understand the relevance of what it is that you have to learn, or you don't understand the relevance of the feedback that you're receiving. So there needs to be some connection with the to be learned information. And if the learner, in whatever context that is, can't recognize what that, or can't understand where that to be learned information fits, i.e. they just don't understand the feedback that they're receiving and how that's going to make them better, or that's how it's going to make them learn, then it's probably going to miss the mark. And so that maybe needs explaining, or learners of some capacity need help understanding that, because you are right. It isn't going to land, and it's not going to be received or acted upon in the way intended.
And then we're starting to get into matters of trust, aren't we? Trust, whether there's lots of it or there's little of it, can really get in the way of that feedback having impact. I'm conscious of not wanting to steal the floor, so Julie, you wanted to come in on a point.
Yeah, I was just going to bring it around to this idea of your beliefs and your values that you were just talking about, Ed, and reflecting on that and on what that means within our learning process. And that really links in nicely to single and double loop learning that that I suspected would come up tonight, and learning theory, which is so important in terms of understanding feedback and the various external and internal governing variables. So just to explain what single and double loop learning is, it's a learning theory by Argyris and Sean. They published it in 1978, so it's dated, but it's still championed. if you think, consider curriculum or your own objectives, strategies and learning outcomes, you have this process of assessment and evaluation. They viewed learning as not the accumulation of knowledge, but the detection and the correction of error. And so any mismatches between what the intended is and the actual results, therefore creating learning loops. It's basically a theory about reflection in action and reflection on action. So the actions, the strategies, governing variables that the action satisfies. So say you have a belief, or an intention, you undertake an action and it has a consequential outcome, and then there's reflective processes. If we separate the single and double loop learning, the single loop is the strategies to the outcome, and the loop learning is actually the reflection on that process, so improving that system that actually already exists. And then the double loop learning is exactly what you're talking about, Ed, the values, the beliefs, the assumptions, the governing variables that influences the action. And then the double loop learning is actually questioning that system. It's why things are as they are. Why do you do what you do? And that's really important in terms of lifelong learning. And that theory is, before I open the stage up to everyone else, is, although it was published in 1978 or thereabouts, scholars now, more contemporary scholars, have really focused on those governing variables, those internal and external factors. So internal factors are things like your personality characteristics, or your emotions, your attitudes, your subjective views, or your sociability. Also your barriers to learning, so defensive reactions. There are things like misinterpretations or limited attention, or even information overload, which we mentioned earlier, and not having enough acquired knowledge, or unhelpful attitudes, or lack of control in decision making. And then the external factors, which are the social, cultural, or environmental, like the immediate learning situation. So all of these things are really important. So when we bring up learning theories, some people just freeze and find it like this academic thing that academics are trying to describe, or and actually it's a very natural process, and considering these. And that's basically what I've done with my in a model from my PhD, is I've combined learning theories, multiple learning theories that explain a process of learning that you can actually apply to various contexts, but as a contribution to my field of music.
Julia, thank you. And I'm kind of hitting myself, we haven't even yet mentioned that we're 3 days out from you submitting the first draft of your PhD. And I know there's a framework within it that you've discussed kind of at a surface level with me, but it's something I'm really, really excited to actually seeing once you, after the next few months, and explore it within the context of sport as well, no doubt. So yeah, watch this space, really excited for that. And both you and Ed have touched on this notion that is spoken of a lot, certainly within sport, of meeting the learners where they're at. And leaning into Anna's work, your biography, which you've just discussed, Julia, and that very much interacting, acting as a filter to guide and influence the way that you respond and engage with learning opportunities. Please cut in here, Anna, I'm looking for a nod. thank you, there we go. And it's hard though, right? It's really hard. Like, I'm working with this really lovely woman at a sports psych, Fionnuala Barnes, and we're about to kickstart a 12-month project with some sailing coaches, sailing and windsurfing coaches. And we discussed how important it might be before we start this to better understand those individuals, and there's 10 of them. But that is a bloody task, so how do you even go about that? Okay, so we'll pick up the phone, but then how long do you stay on the phone for, and how much can you really grasp? So I'm not doing that work, fortunately. Fionnuala, with her expertise, is doing that. But, it's like we arrived at this point in the conversation where it was like, well, let's get to know them. But that's really difficult and really time consuming. And I can understand that you can do that over the course of a project. But if you're bringing new learners in who you perhaps don't know, to try and better understand them is hard. And I have no doubt that Anna would have some strategies to support that she could maybe offer. But I wonder if we can segue slightly now. We've talked a lot about similarities across our context, and I wonder, we might not, but I wonder if we might find some differences. So I'm going to ask Julia first a question that we had lined up for this episode, which was, what sociocultural influences enable and or constrain feedback in your context? And so we'll start with Julia again, and then Ed or Dave, please jump in.
So before I really delve into the benefits and the issues with my context, it's probably a good idea just for those not familiar with it to describe what the context is where feedback in one-to-one lessons sit. So one-to-one lessons take place in conservatoires, and conservatoires for performing musicians are the bastions of excellence. They're equivalent to universities for the performing arts. And so performing musicians go to conservatoires to develop their performing skills, and really at the heart and the core of that learning is the one-to-one context. And so your experiences with your teachers are massively important to your learning. If that relationship doesn't work out, it can actually really disrupt your learning quite significantly. Notable constructive and destructive evidence of within literature and also personally, through my friends and colleagues, people fear speaking about their experiences with bad feedback because teachers are often the gatekeepers to the world of work, and those pools of people are pretty small. So for example, if you have a flautist and your teacher's a flautist who plays with all the orchestras or one of the orchestras, you don't want to piss them off because you want to get work. So there's a little bit of fear going on. So the way that you're paired with the teacher, you go to consultation lessons, or some people go to consultation lessons beforehand. You have an hour long lesson with them, sometimes 2 hours or three. In that time, you decide whether you like each other and whether you're going to work together for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years. Sometimes people have multiple consultations. Other people just have blind faith in the institution and let them pair them with the teacher. Often students go to teachers for their reputation, so their performing reputation. Maybe later we can talk about how one of the main issues in music education, in higher music education, is that there's a massively wide-held assumption that the great performer is the great teacher, and actually they are two very different skill sets, similar in some ways, but those skills are tacitly learned through or informally learned through experiences with your own teachers and performing experience. So the context, the one-to-one lesson, it takes place behind closed doors. It's private in nature, and it's actually in empirical research not very transparent what actually takes place. There's a lot of benefits to that. So the sole focus of the teacher is on the student, and the teacher can essentially create bespoke experiences according to the student's needs. Whether teachers actually do that is another question. That literature could delve into that a bit more. But you can target student weakness. There's also the reduced potential for peer comparison. So that means that the student can learn at their own pace, and teachers, they're often seen as a long-term support. Certainly for me, with my four key teachers in my life, they acted as a champion, and they were incredibly supportive. There are issues with this. So again, like I said, the assumption that there's the great performer is the great teacher. To teach instrumentals in high-level music lessons, you don't need a teaching accreditation or qualifications, which is quite incredible if you think about what a classroom teacher needs to do to be able to even teach kids. Again, higher music education, you're teaching young adults, but even so, it is surprising that they don't kind of learn the skills of teaching formally. Continued professional development is kind of coming into play more and more, but if and those institutions that do have continued professional development that tends to be voluntary. One institution I spoke to recently said that 80% don't undertake a continued professional development, which is also alarming. I think I'd also like to add before I finish that the one-to-one lesson has been a learning context in classical music for over 200 years, and it's seen enormous success. But there are instances of destructive experiences, and you wonder if teachers were also trained to teach, what impact that would have on student learning, and that should be the primary focus rather than kind of being in any way stubborn about how things have been done traditionally. Education is continually evolving, and teaching and knowledge and skills should evolve too.
Wonderful, Julia. What an insight. Oh my word. Faces were nodding, heads were nodding, sorry. I do not a face. I don't know, Dave or Ed, do you want to, who wants to follow up on Julia? A little bit about influences in your context.
Yeah, I don't mind. I think Derek's kind of nailed it a little bit in the chat around impression management, and I guess in coaching, there's an expectation, I think, on what a coach is or isn't. And so that will determine what the role of a coach is and what they're expected to do. And that can come from the athlete, but more often than not, it comes from, you know, expectations from parents, perhaps, other coaches within that context, policymakers. And so everybody has an idea of what a coach should do and what they should be like. And those forces ultimately impact on what a coach ends up doing. And so, you know, if a coach feels they have to conform to the status quo within their particular context because they've got senior coaches who believe certain things about what good coaching is or isn't, then it takes a brave person, I guess, not to conform to those ideas, particularly if their job is on the line. And so what you end up with is, and if anybody's ever kind of looked at the occupational socialization literature, you end up with like organizational socialization, which is like the third step of it, where you could enter professional socialization, which is where you might do a degree in coaching or teaching or whatever else it might be. And you get exposed to these ideas and like what might be considered newer ideas about what good practice looks like and what good coaches do and so on. And so you come out of those, that professional socialization, kind of wanting to implement all these new ideas. But because the context isn't receptive to that, what often happens is this process of organizational socialization where those ideas quite quickly get washed out because they're not supported. And so you then revert back to previous ideas that you will have previously worked to before getting exposed to these new ideas. So I guess, you know, the forces of the context are extremely powerful, and, you know, what coaches probably intend to do at times can't always manifest themselves in practice because the context in a variety of different ways doesn't allow it to happen. So I guess that's my response really to that.
It's a slightly different environment for me because it is a Scottish school, you know, a public school that the social and cultural factors that can get in the way of good feedback and good learning are massive in the school. Because as I said before, we're getting the full cross section of society, you know, all levels of deprivation and affluence. And I think my school rolls 1400 or 1500, sort of goes up and down. I think it's about 1450 just now. About 1300 of them come to maths and I have responsibility for, and 2/3 of them, whether they like it or not, will be delivered down to the maths department because it is a legislative requirement that they be educated in that way. So the culture in the classroom, it can make or break it, right? The culture that the teacher creates, that the leaders of the school create, and they're constantly creating it. Everybody's contributing to it, and the pupils themselves create. You can have one tyrannical, threatening, you know, male, female pupil, it doesn't matter, in the class that can just eliminate all learning because they come from a culture where it's not cool to learn, right? This isn't something you aspire to do, and therefore kids will not, they're more reticent, you know, to take that step to engage with the learning. And everybody will have been taught by a teacher who themselves created a really toxic environment and gave the worst kind of feedback you can imagine, you know, to just completely turn pupils off from subjects and from learning in general. The culture from which the kids are coming plays such a massive role. And obviously we get very little of that. The further up the school in terms of the management structure you get, the more you learn. But as a classroom teacher, it is a mystery why the pupil sitting, you know, in the front row on the left is thriving and the person sitting next to them doesn't engage. You know, it just appears as that. I mean, to be honest, it's always a mystery in any way. But I think that sometimes once you start to get and dig a little deeper, you can find that actually there's kids that are thriving in school, and that is not something that the parents are aware of, right? They might come from a culture in the household in which they weren't processed learners, they weren't interested in maths when they were at school, yet they're really switched on in school. And the pupil that we describe to the parents is a stranger, right? Like they don't recognize this person. But that is often indicative of pupils that have received really quality feedback in a great culture. And the culture sometimes in a school exists in just a few classrooms, and in really good schools, it's evident everywhere. You know, it's almost tangible. And more than anything, I think that if you talk to educationalists, that it's that culture that can help to mitigate so many of the problems that are elsewhere, so that the pupils in the school, regardless of what level of maths they're studying or indeed which subject they're studying in, can thrive and to get better. And to recognize here at this point, because we're not talking about elite levels of athletes or musicians, can get better from wherever they are at that point. And that's a really key part of Scottish education. That's the equity angle, giving them the resources and the feedback that they need for them to thrive and for them to be successful.
Yeah, I don't really want to rip the arse out of it, but it's conscious in my mind because of a conversation I had this morning with a sport. And we talk about the role of challenge in the talent and performance pathway. And creating both challenging and supportive environments for athletes to flourish within. Now we can also bring that to musicians, or we could bring that to students, right? And I'm really interested to understand the guest perspective on the role of parents in supporting the feedback process. We don't need to go too in depth, but keen to just understand. From a coherence perspective, the messages that you're giving as an educator or as an instructor in music or a coach in football ed, how you're collaborating with parents to ensure that message is heard.
Yeah, I mean, this is, of course, this is a challenge. I guess, you know, parents are probably the in some ways the biggest issue. And that's not disrespectful, because I think every parent has their or believes that they've got their kids' interests at their, you know, their the best interests of their kids at heart. But we know that, you know, the misunderstanding from parents in terms of how they think they are supporting their children in whatever capacity that might be, is a challenge for the educator, I think. And, you know, even if I think back to my parents, and there's instances now where both in a sport and in a more broader educational setting, you know, I receive feedback from them, which I now think, God, that was absolutely horrendous. And these aren't bad people, like they're far from it, you know, and they mean well, but they're not educators, right? Yet they're the ones who ultimately have the most time spent with these people, and therefore can influence them more than anybody. And so, you know, invariably, if they don't understand how to give good feedback, and if they don't understand how to interact, and I actually think that, you know, parents probably saying very little in some ways isn't actually a bad thing, and certainly in a coaching and in a football context, I certainly think that that's the case. In that, you know, make sure that the their athlete or their child feels loved, they feel cared for, they feel like, you know, they've got their support. But support comes in a variety of different ways. You know, taking them to and from practice and so on and so forth is a sign of support. And I guess leave the feedback in some ways, and leave the role of trying to develop the player to the person who's primarily responsible for doing that, without wishing to say that the parent has no role in that. So it's a really difficult one. And I know parental education is becoming more and more popular, particularly again in sport and in coaching and in football contexts. And, you know, this is where maybe guidance and tips for parents is useful. I'm not sure how kind of that happens in music or broader education. You know, I'd be interested, you know, is the parents' evening, you know, it says it in the title, isn't it? Is it for the parents or is it for the kids? And, you know, what do the parents then do with the information that they get from the teacher at parents' evening, and how does that then get conveyed to the kids? You know, I'd imagine it either equates to a telling off or a pat on the back and some pocket money. I don't really know, but it's a great question. Maybe more time's needed to answer it.
It's a parents' evening. It's a parents' evening, right? It's an evening for parents. I like it when the kid's there, though, right? Because you can earn integrity points, you know, that you're the same person in speaking to their parents as you are when you deal with them in the classroom. You're saying the same messages, because kids are so quick to spot, you know, somebody that doesn't have integrity or someone they think is treating them unfairly. And especially moving from primary to secondary, it's really difficult for parents and carers, because they have, I don't know how primary teachers do it, you know, where they have the same kids all day. You know, no matter how much my perfect lesson has fallen apart, I can think, right, it's not too long before I can draw a line under this and start again tomorrow. Whereas they have them all day, right, and they have to simultaneously, they are contemporaneously delivering while planning for the next transition into something else. And the parents have this ongoing relationship, and they can build trust, and there's still these opportunities to speak to them at the, you know, when they pick the kids up every day, and when they go to this behemoth secondary school that is faceless, and the kids somewhere in there, and they have all these teachers, you know, when they come to secondary school, they might have like 13, maybe 15 people, that it becomes faceless, and where they are uninformed, suspicion, you know, fills that void. And a lot, and reading Goodall in this is just, she's so concise in her points, and they can come up on the defensive, and any interaction can go south really quickly. The written communication can be really difficult as well. What we're talking about at the start, you know, having been able to speak to people face to face, where they can see that your nonverbal communication matches what you're saying, is something we've picked a lot up. We've all become more upskilled in ICT, so we've done a lot of video messages for parents just now, who are understandably really anxious about how the heck these kids are going to get these qualifications. Generally speaking, I think a great approach with parents and trying to win them over is always that you are asking for their support, and that you are trying to work together, and always try and make those sentiments permeate any communication I have with them. And, you know, at the start of the year, if I've got a course, I'll set up a group, you know, on the Mail Merge system for the parents of those kids in that course, and keep them informed as we go through. I think that helps a lot. But they can really quickly undo, you know, so much good work. You know, that it's a bit of a cliche, but I was crap at maths at school. That undoes everything, because you're handing the kid the only excuse they need not to work, right? My dad was crap at maths, he's fine, right? So it just switches them off. Whereas the message needs to be, drawn, you don't need to get all this. You don't need to be an expert in this. I just need you to believe me that I have your kid's best interest at heart, and that if you, like we were talking about earlier, praise their efforts, ask them, you know, what mistake they learned from there, and talk about improvement as opposed to being the best, and which class they're in, and how their best friend did in some test and externalizing it all. It's just so toxic, you know. And we get these messages through, like, I heard such and such, and I'm really concerned about this. And they sign it off, the fact that they're an MP or they work at the council or something like this, you know, like, put it up on Facebook. It just snowballs, you know. Oh, God. Yeah, but I'm positive about it, right? I am optimistic.
Thanks, Dave. Julia?
Yeah, so in music, I suppose, I mean, I teach children and young adults, so I can relate to this question about parents and overbearing parents. Yeah, so, well, two things actually are coming to mind. First of all, the one-to-one context, when you're with a kid or even an adult, it's quite a, I don't know what it is about the context, but maybe it's because the teacher's attention is solely on one student, but they often in that context bring personal problems to you, and teachers need to know how to, and you know, to do with their parents. Their parents can be difficult with them, and they talk to you about that, and you have to kind of steer them on task. And I think teacher training should really, really make sure that teachers are familiar about how to deal with that appropriately, because you are encroaching on something that's potentially a boundary issue. It's not on task, you know, that kind of thing. The other thing is, for those music teachers listening could really relate that some parents want to sit in on the one-to-one lesson. And I actually feel totally fine with that once or twice. But if they taking notes for the student, if they're interrupting the lesson, so we can, you know, I really make sure that, although, you know, we're talking about instruction, but I also really I'm aware that I want to develop the student's autonomy. I want to develop the student's ability to self-regulate themselves, and self-regulation is about self-control and their ability to align their own values, not their parents' values, with what they're doing. And so there does come a point where I make it really explicitly clear, if you want to do that, I'm totally happy that you can come for once or twice, and then there is, you know, where I'm on my way with that student. So yeah, that's what that came to mind.
Julia, I'll just jump in there before we wrap up. You talk about staying out. Both my kids get music lessons on a weekly basis, as you know, and in lockdown it's fucking impossible to, because they're having it in the room, right? So you say, you know, I'm gonna leave you there, guys, and you go through to the next room and you pretend that you're far away, and you say, if you need anything, come and get me, you know. So occasionally they will, and you'll have that little pause, like pretending you were really far away, but really you were in the next room. anyway, yeah, hilarity. I think we had a quick fire question, but I'm looking at the time and I wonder if we should just wrap up and I'll do the rounds to Anna. Derek, what do you think? Do we want to do the quick fire? Let's ask the guests. Do you want to do the quick fire, or are you happy to wrap up? Julia is saying quick fire. We'll make it quick fire then. Right, Anna, go for it.
Okay. I get the coveted quick fire role. So we'll start with Ed, then we'll go to Dave, then finish off with Julia. So when considering a feedback strategy to support learning, what do you believe are a few of the most important considerations to make of the learners?
So first of all, recognise where the learner is at as best as possible, and the feedback should be aligned with what it is that the learner needs and wants from that feedback. So if they are finding something difficult, then don't be afraid to be more prescriptive. Don't be afraid to show and tell in order to give that frame of reference to help support them, so that they are getting a reference point and an understanding of what it is that you're asking them to do, or what they need to be able to do to solve the problem that's in front of them. Then I guess, as they become more proficient in having that knowledge, or that procedural knowledge to understand how something needs to be done, then we can start to fade and remove that feedback to allow kind of more intrinsic feedback from the learner to take hold, and for them to recognize that actually they've been in a similar situation before, and it's important that they then start to retrieve the knowledge that they need to deal with that problem. And so, again, it might sound quite cliche now to say, let's start with the athlete, but that is what I believe. And so that should determine and inform the approach we adopt. And I guess that's one example of how that would actually play out in practice.
Yeah, I agreed with a lot of what Ed said there. For me, it's really about my knowledge of the learner. And where they're coming from and where they're at with respect to what we're trying to achieve at that time, how they have responded to feedback in the past, and how much they've been contributing to the lesson in what we're currently learning. But there really is no getting around that. It's for me, it's all about the relationship with the learner in the first place, and whether I'm dealing with them in a full class context, or maybe it's in a supported study context, or recently in a digital context. Yeah.
Thank you. And finally, last but not least, Julia, what are your thoughts?
So first of all, when considering, you have to consider their goals and your goals. Do they align? It's really important to reach a shared understanding. Are you explicitly communicating that and seeking that information from your students? In terms of preferences for type of feedback, I'd say asking people, what do they perceive to be acceptable and not acceptable? What do I perceive as a teacher to be acceptable and not acceptable? Am I communicating that? Are we reaching a shared understanding in that respect? Some people like harsh critique. They actually thrive off it. Other people are much more sensitive to criticism. So I really believe communicating that verbally is really important. Consideration of barriers to learning, observation, talking about that, and it's actually, you can learn through that. So it's developing self-awareness. Also ability, self-reflection, their abilities to problem solve. This is all using your own judgment and perceptibility. What are their self-regulatory skills like? Again, this could be communicated through explicit verbal communication. I'd also say it's really, really important. I'd say for athletes and kids and for musicians, it's really important that the mentor seeks verbal feedback, checks understanding. Are you reaching shared intentions? So that basically means the more you can more accurately gauge the feedback and whether that can be useful for them.
Great, I like that loop back to the feedback for the coach or the teacher or the mentor, as you put it. Laurie, you look like you've got something to say to wrap us up.
Do I? I'll keep it short and snappy then. Season 2, episode 1, what a belter. Far surpassed my expectations. Contributions from Dave, Ed, Julia and the lawnmower outside your window, Julia, have been pretty exceptional this evening. So just thank you so much, everyone. Derek, Anna, anyone else want to say anything before we wrap up?
Thank you again for the invite, guys. Really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed listening to the different perspectives. So a good start to the Easter weekend.
I'm just curious, who bloody mows their lawn at 8 o'clock at night?
I know.
Someone with floodlights.
No, just to echo what Laurie said, look, this isn't doing a disservice or disrespecting anybody else we've had on the pod, but this has been my most enjoyable episode thus far. So thank you very much for sharing your perspectives with humility, but more importantly, with honesty as well. So thank you very much.
I just really want to learn maths from Dave and brush up my piano with Julia. I already work with Ed, so.
I was about to say, I wondered where that was going then.
Thanks so much, guys. So interesting to hear from all of your perspectives. Brilliant.
Yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me along.